this was a traumatic moment for the Israeli society. The way people were killed, the kind of people who were killed, although we don't know until today how many were killed by the Israeli army, how many were brutally killed by Palestinians, how many died as soldiers in fighting Palestinian guerrillas. All this is not very clear, but no doubt it was a traumatic moment, and there was a sense of revenge, and part of the action was response to the kind of things that happened on the ground. But it's very clear that it turned very quickly into a different kind of operation, which had behind it an ideology and a strategy. And I think it goes back to the 1948 ethnic cleansing from a different angle. If you look at the 1948 ethnic cleansing in a very cynical way, you can say it was not successful, because half of the Palestinians remained in Palestine, and many millions of Palestinians remained close to Palestine. And in the refugee camp, the Palestinians, contrary to what Zionist leaders thought would happen, did not forget and did not die without passing to the next generation the desire to liberate Palestine, to fight for its liberation. So in that respect, as terrible as the ethnic cleansing of 48 was, it was also incomplete. And it was also incomplete because Israel, for its own, I don't have time to go into it, for all kinds of strategic reasons, decided not to occupy the West Bank in 48, although it had all the power to do that. So when they did complete the occupation of the whole of historical Palestine in 1967, they incorporated again a large number of Palestinians, almost the same number of Palestinians that they had expelled in 1948, which is another reason why a certain stream of Zionism that began to develop in Israel, which I call Neo-Zionism, the Messianic Zionism, felt that it had the power to rectify the mistakes, the so-called mistakes, of the previous Zionist leadership in 1948 and in 1967. And these people, who were quite on the margins of Israeli politics until the 21st century, are now dominating Israel. They took over the educational system, the cultural system, the political system, the army, the police, the secret service. And they have a very clear idea of how to rectify which they think was a mistake in 1948, namely not to expel all the Palestinians and take over the whole of Palestine. In fact, not just the whole of Palestine, but also parts of what they think was the ancient biblical Israel, namely Jordan and some parts of South Lebanon and South Syria. These people that used to be regarded in Israel a bit as lunatics are now the powers that be in Israel. And they were already the powers that be in November 2022. And they are the ones who, without any inhibitions, turned the Israeli reaction to the 7th of October into a genocide campaign. In many ways, you can say historically that Israel is transformed from being a settler colonial state, and it's not the only settler colonial state. You are now living in a settler colonial state. Israel's turned it from a settler colonial state into a genocidal state. And a genocidal state has to be confronted morally and legally and in aspect of legitimacy in a very, even in a more different way than a settler colonial state. But of course, the international community, the political elites at least, are not yet absorbing this, digesting it, or are willing to act. But I think we should be with open eyes to understand that the current political elite, and it doesn't matter what would be the results of the elections in April 26 in Israel, the current political elite is determined to continue what it started in Gaza in the last 2 years and move with it to the West Bank, then to the Palestinian community inside Israel, and expand the Israeli territorial space beyond the boundaries of historical Palestine. Now, I would like to say that, first of all, I don't think they will succeed. I'm just talking about plans. And secondly, I think that this is an indication of something that could make us optimistic about the future. This total exposure of the project that you could have conveyed or commodified, if you want, in the past as an ambiguous project of democracy and human rights and civil rights and salvaging Jews on the one hand, with unfortunately the need to colonize, occupy, and ethnically cleansing. The whole idea of the Jewish democratic state, as if it's possible to have a racist state that also adheres to principles of democracy and universal values. But somehow the West, in particular, the political elites in the West, especially the left in the West, was very happy with this idea that, yes, you could somehow square this circle. This is gone because the people in Israel who subscribe to these ideas are also the enemies of the new neo-Zionist messianic elite that took over Israel. They are also the enemies, not only the Palestinians. And they don't seem to fight back. They seem to emigrate instead of fighting back. Some of them are fighting back. You can see it on the streets of Tel Aviv, but I don't think they have a chance of winning. This will expose Israel as a genocidal state, which means in the short term, we are very worried of what it's going to do. And as always, the immediate victims of their fanaticism, racism, and extremism are the Palestinians themselves. However, it must, because it happened before in history, wake up many more people to understand that this is a state that should be treated as a pariah state, that this is a state that doesn't have internal dynamics of change. And that requires a different regional and international reaction. Now, I know we're presently, we have political elites in the region and in the international community who would do nothing about this. I don't have to tell you this, but I'm an historian and I'm not impressed by stills. I'm impressed by videos. I don't think the picture we see today, populist leaders in America, populist fascist leaders in Europe, rulers rather than leaders in the Arab world, in other parts, in the global south, are the future. I think what Gaza did, it took millions of people of civil society out to the streets, not just because of Gaza, but because of the essence of politics that they are facing in their own countries, facing their own ecological, social, economic injustices in their countries or in the world. And yes, this massive solidarity with Palestine that goes beyond the issue of Palestine, as we've seen from the millions who demonstrated in Italy, for instance, has not yet been translated in any infrastructural way, organizational way, institutional way to become a counterforce to populism, fascism, racism. I will finish by saying that we are at the juncture in history where if you see Gaza as the epicenter for a while, and epicenters do change. Vietnam could be an epicenter, South Africa was an epicenter, Central America was epicenter. Gaza was the epicenter in the last 2 years. And seen from that epicenter, you can see two global coalitions confronting each other. And we should hope that we are part of the coalition that I think that would win the day eventually, but not immediately, unfortunately. So one is the global Israel. Global Israel are all these members of the alliance that see even a messianic, racist, fanatic, extreme Israel as serving their interest. Maybe these are Christian Zionists who believe that this is just getting them even nearer to the return of the Messiah and the end of time. Maybe these are multinational corporations that believe that Israel's high-tech ability brings them dividends. Maybe, surely it is military industry and security industries, maybe oil industries, who think that Israel is a bonanza rather than a liability. And Jewish communities who still regard Israel as an insurance state, although this is ridiculous because the only place where Jews are being killed in high numbers is in Israel. Nonetheless, even those who are cynically support Israel, not ideologically or morally, would find out that the kind of Israel that we have now, which I call in my last book, the State of Judea, I don't think we have Israel anymore. We have the State of Judea. this state of Judea would make it difficult even to be a worthy investment for members of that coalition that now see it as bringing dividends, mostly financial, maybe strategic dividends. It is faced by Global Palestine. Global Palestine is all these networking, intersectional networking between trade unions, indigenous minorities, oppressed minorities, people who fight for ecological justice and economic justice, people who understand that without credible international legal system, you cannot create global cooperation to face global warming, poverty, immigration in any effective way. This is Global Palestine, and Global Palestine took out millions in an unprecedented show of support for Palestine that has never been seen since the arrival of Zionism to Palestine. The numbers were very small in demonstrations for Palestine up to Gaza. Therefore, I do think that we should believe that that Global Palestine is the one that may eventually recruit also more reasonable political elites, financial elites, and economic elites, first of all, to take urgent action to defend the Palestinians from the next stages of the attempt to expunge Palestine as a country, as a people, as a culture, as a history. And secondly, would be willing to understand that the whole vocabulary that was used by genuine or cynical people who were interested in bringing peace to the Holy Land was wrong. There's no need for peace. What there is need for is decolonization. What there is need is transitional justice. And more than anything else, there's a need to listen to the Palestinians and hear them. What are their aspirations for the future of Palestine? And start with them and let them be in the driver's seat and tell us how they view the future of Palestine. And I'm sure that you all know that they wish to reconnect it to the Arab world. They want to see the refugees and their descendants coming back. They want to see equality. They want to see democracy. They want to have normal life that have been denied to them for the last century or so. I do believe that this will happen. I do believe that this, in the long term, there are already indications that the global Israel and Israel itself is not sustainable in the long run. But I am worried about the next 2 or 3 or 4 years, I do admit. I hope we can all be alert and have the best way of using any kind of politics that we have to tame it, to limit it. But we should think about the future as harboring justice and liberation and freedom for the people of Palestine, and with it, I think, a lot of other struggles for injustice in the Arab world and beyond will also benefit from such a vision. Thank you.
Q&A. I wanted to ask you, Professor Pape, about Britain and the whole thing going on with Palestine Action and just the brutal way that they've prohibited speech around Palestine and arrested a bunch of people who are on hunger strike and some of them in very delicate health because of that. I wonder if you could tell us any more about that. It sounds like England is getting just as brutal in its treatment of Palestinian resistance as the United States with university students.
Definitely. I think that, like in some other Western European countries, the demonstrations for Palestine gave a pretext for some sections of the government, especially in the security services, a pretext to curb freedom of speech. We've seen it after 9/11, a similar kind of attitude. It's kind of gives them an excuse to say that there's too much freedom of expression, exploiting Islamophobia, the pressure of the pro-Zionist lobby in Britain to show action. I do think that they got themselves into trouble with the Palestine Action by so quickly proscribing it as a terrorist organization. I don't think they expected that the society would react in such a way. I mean, most of the people they arrest for raising signs of support of Palestine Action are between 70 and 90 years old. And each one of them requires 25 policemen to escort them to the car and from the car to the police station. I think I have a feeling that the Supreme Court, the High Court in England, would eventually interfere, but it will take some time. But nonetheless, that doesn't change the fact that this is still a cowardly behavior, and it doesn't matter whether you have a conservative government or a Labour government that still believes that supporting or at least being indifferent towards what Israel is doing serves its interest. There's also fear of the United States here as well. It goes back to what I said before. I don't think these are local battles between people who fight for freedoms and people who want to curb them. I think it's very global, and each of these governments that uses demonstrations for Palestine as a pretext to curb freedom of expression is doing it for the same reason that other governments are doing it. And we should look for an international alliance, because in some countries, the local alliances are not strong enough to face that kind of dictatorship and lack of respect for our basic civil and human rights.
It seemed to me you went very fast from the rise of what you're calling New Zionism in Israel to a kind of assumption that that's going to prevail from now on. And I wondered why you went so, why you didn't seem to consider the idea of a moderate Israeli pushback and retreat from the current genocide.
Because I'm spending much of my time also in Israel, and I can see it with my own eyes. So it's not just an analysis from afar. This is knowing the beast from within. I do see that the younger generation, and that is what is important, the younger generation has graduated from education system that can only lead it to support the neo-Zionists. There are very few young people on the other side. Yes, you still have people in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who want to preserve the old Israel. But they usually have dual nationalities. They have jobs that they can reignite elsewhere. That's why we estimate that 500,000 of them already left. So instead of fighting, they're leaving. So that's one of the reasons I don't think that there will be a counter-Israel. And more importantly, their leaders have nothing to offer as an alternative. And that is what is worrying. If they had a bold position that says, let's rethink about this whole relationship between us and the Palestinians, between the river and the sea, they might have had created a counter-Israel. But they still want to square the circle. They want to be what Albert Mami used to call the leftist colonizers. They want to be colonizers, but nice colonizers. They want to be ethnic cleansers, but to be progressive ethnic cleansers. This is not working. It didn't work, and that's why most Israelis said, well, that's much better to decide whether we want to be a racist state or democracy. We prefer to be a racist state. So these people don't have roots. They in large sections of the society, demographically they are not growing. They are important for the economy, for the academy, but you can read the Haaretz today. The academy is being totally drained because people don't want to stay. I don't see any potential force that will fight back in an effective way. Nor does it have a vision that could really prove to people that they have something else to offer. None of these people who are now supposedly being the alternative condemned the genocide. They did not call it the genocide. None of them has done anything to protect the Palestinians in the West Bank from the terrible ethnic cleansing operation that Israel has committed. And all of them are complaining that the world is against them. This is not an alternative. So I'm afraid we've reached that position where there is no dynamics of change from within. And the only way of growing a proper alternative Jewish voice inside Israel is only once, I think, decolonization would start it. It's not a precondition for decolonization. I say it with very, I'm very sad to say it. I'm an Israeli Jew. I don't want it to be like this, but that's the only way I can see it working. I do hope that international pressure and regional pressure would be enough, and there would no need for violence to do that. That depends on the region and the international community. There's a way of changing it, but the way does not go through creating an alternative inside Israel, but first of all, punishing Israel for what it's doing, and then maybe you can begin to see something different developing. That's the historical moment we are in it, and we have to recognize it. I point out to discrete mini-revolutions that each one of them by themselves would not change the reality on the ground, but together, when they will fuse together, they will have a transformative effect. That's my judgment as a historian from the way regime changed or states disintegrated in the past. One of them is the implosion inside the Israeli Jewish society, and we already talked about it, the takeover by the Judea state, the state of Judea of Israel. This is going to weaken considerably Israel. The other one is the vision of having this kind of Israel means that Israel would have to have an economy of war for another 10, 20 years. Economy of war that stretches over decades is not sustainable in terms of the state's ability to take care about the needs of its own society. Much depends on the American taxpayers now for that kind of militarization in front of a future that is only full of conflict and bloodshed. But one wonders if the American taxpayers would continue to pay the huge sums of money, and they would have to be much higher than they have been until today to sustain the state of Judea and its ambition. So I think that even Republicans in America might have second thoughts about whether Israel is a liability or an asset. The other one has to do with the fact that the younger Jewish generation, including the United States, disassociate themselves from Zionism. And then you have the international community, not only the societies. I do believe that there will be a transformation that will begin to affect political elites. As Noam Chomsky puts it, the movement between B and D, the boycott and divestment, to the S, to the sanctions. I also think there are currents, undercurrents in the Arab world that would create a very different political reality and can create different reality in the Arab world that would face Israel not with small guerrilla armies, but a far more formidable challenge that I think, together with the other pressures, might have an impact on its policies and identity, and the identity of the regime. And finally, I would just mention quickly, one is, I do think that the younger Palestinian generation is far more united, less fragmented from the present compared to the present political polity of Palestine. And I do believe that they have a potential of putting a very different vision for Palestine that the world would not be able to ignore. So all of these and others, as I say, not by themselves, but I do believe that together they are mini revolutions, I call them. Some of them do not depend on us. Some of them we have a very important role in making them come true.
A question for you. Are you able to travel to Israel-Palestine?
Yes, so far I am. I'm not able to teach. I'm not able to enter schools. But yes, I'm still able. I don't know how long they're going to do this. With this particular government, there's no telling. So yes, the answer is yes. And this is particularly important for me because of what I call the forgotten Palestinians, the 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel. We haven't talked about them, but they are also under a policy which is callous, inhuman, and it's a different kind of oppression, but a very terrible one. And I'm very happy if I can still be with my friends and colleagues and comrades there to do all we can also to help and defend this particular community of Palestinians, as I say, 2 million Palestinians that usually are not talked about understandably maybe because of what goes on in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but they're very important, and they will be very important for the future.
You were just listening to Ilan Pappe on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He spoke in January 2026. Ilan Pappe has been called Israel's bravest historian. He's the author of many books, including A Very Short History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as David Corton, Winona LaDuke, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Claudia de la Cruz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Ilan Pappe on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and for his book, A Very Short History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Community Church of Boston. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Oud Virtuoso, Marcel Khalife, Birds of the Galilee.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. The catchy name Jackdaw belongs to a European bird that looks like a compact crow drawn in shades of light and dark gray. Jackdaws fly in aerobatic flocks, tumbling and swooping along the vertical faces of cliffs and buildings. They're comfortable around people, which helps explain their place in folklore for many centuries. An ancient Greek myth held that to catch one, you need only a bowl of oil. Attracted to its own reflection, the bird will fall face first into the oil for easy capture. Some cultures saw the jackdaw as a predictor of rain, others as a savior of crops, or possibly an omen of death. And some believed crossing paths with a jackdaw en route to your wedding was a sign of good luck. Pairs nest in cavities, and flocks roam open country, parks, farmland, quarries, and churchyards. They flourish in urban landscapes, too, where their mellow chatter announces that a tight flock will soon come streaming by, almost as if they wanted to dazzle you. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.